Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Stephen B. Small died in one of the most horrific ways a person can die, being buried alive. He was one of the richest men in Kankakee, Illinois, in 1987, which made him the target of a desperate cocaine dealer who wanted to collect $1 million ransom. Everything went tragically wrong. Danny Edwards was caught, convicted, and was sentenced to death. His life was spared after all death sentences were commuted to life in prison by Governor George Ryan. A conviction of Danny Edwards was a sure thing. However, political pressure, the Small family was at the top of Kankakee's powerful elite, brought in the top prosecutors in the state so that they could use Edwards' case against his girlfriend, Nancy Risch. Their case against her was flimsy. At best, every piece of forensic evidence at the trial cleared Nancy Risch. Not one piece of evidence and not one witness testimony proved her guilt, but she was convicted on the conjecture and false assertions of the prosecutors. There was no more evidence against her than the supposition that she had to know what Edwards was planning. Every public defender and lawyer refused to defend her because of alleged conflicts or fear of the local powers. Everything was set up to railroad this woman into prison. She did not get a fair trial. She didn't stand a chance. If Danny Edwards had picked any other victim, his girlfriend never would have been prosecuted. Nancy Risch got small justice. Nancy Risch is innocent. Danny Edwards did not cooperate with the police, and he never talked about the details of his crime until now. Danny Edwards and Nancy Risch have given their first in-depth interviews from prison to author Jim Ridings for this book. The incredible story and previously unknown background details are told here for the first time. This is not just the story of a sensational kidnapping and murder. It is also the story of how a corrupt system was able to convict an innocent woman and send her to prison for life. The book that we're featuring this evening is Small Justice, with my special guest journalist and author, Jim Ridings. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Jim Ridings.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for this interview. Let's start off with introducing Stephen Small and the Small family, and what is their importance in Kankakee, Illinois?
Well, all this happened in Kankakee, which is a city of about 27,000 people, about an hour south of Chicago. The Small family has been the most prominent family in Kankakee for more than 100 years. Stephen Small's great-grandfather was Len Small, who was governor of Illinois for 8 years in the 1920s. He was the most corrupt politician the state had ever seen. He was connected to the Klan, he was connected to Al Capone, and so on and so forth. The family used the ill-gotten gains to buy farms and newspapers, radio stations. They owned the daily paper in Kankakee. Stephen Small, as I said, is the great-grandson. He was worth tens of millions, all the Smalls are. This made him a target for somebody who wanted to kidnap.
Now, speaking of that, let's introduce Danny Edwards. And what were his criminal charges in April 1987, the conditions of his sentence, and the arrangement he had with authorities as a result?
Danny Edwards was a longtime drug dealer. He had been busted in early 1987. He faced up to 30 years in prison, but the authorities wanted to get a higher-up drug dealer. They focused on somebody named Mitch Levitz. They made a deal with Danny. They said, we'll give you probation if you help us bust Levitz, if you give us the name of a number of customers, and if you help us find out who was leaking information from the courthouse. Danny did give them the names of 18 people and what they bought. He agreed to set up Mitch Levitz. They met at a place near Chicago where Danny was supposed to buy a certain amount of cocaine. But Levitz was smart. He knew that something was up. Danny had a cut on his face, and Mitch thought maybe the police had gotten him and beat him up a little bit. And Danny also had an undercover policeman waiting outside in the car. So Levitz wouldn't deal with him. He just walked out. Well, Danny failed to set the guy up, but they still gave him probation anyway, because that was part of the deal. They kept to the deal. But Danny wasn't going to deal any more drugs for a while, because he knew he was going to go away for a long time if he got caught. So he decided to that he would kidnap Mr. Small, one of the wealthiest men in Kankakee and most politically powerful men. He would kidnap him and hold him for $1 million ransom. He spent months working on this plan. It didn't have much thought to it. He got some wood and he started building a plywood box. His intention was that he was going to go out to the sandhill, the wooded sandhill outside of town, dig a hole and put the box in, kidnap Mr. Small and take him out and put him in the box and cover it up and then make some calls. And that's what he did.
Let's talk about Nancy Risch and her relationship with Danny Edwards. Tell us the living situation at this time in September 1987, but tell us, go backwards and tell us a little bit about their relationship and how you would characterize it, and tell us a little bit more about Nancy Risch.
Well, Danny and Nancy had met in a bar, and he pursued her. She, held him off for a while, but eventually she gave in. Danny ended up divorcing his wife, and Danny and Nancy moved in, but they had problems and they were not exactly getting along. So Danny, after the drug bust, Danny set Nancy up in the townhouse. And he continued to live in the house where they had lived. Because he had no more money coming in drug deal, he couldn't afford to pay for both places. So since he was paying for Nancy's townhouse, he told her he wanted to move in. She could hardly say no, because he was paying the bill. So he moved in.
Let's talk about this kidnapping that you talked about that Danny Edwards had planned, maybe not planned so well, but he had planned this for many, many months. He built the box with the assistance of Nancy's cousin, who he was at least pretending to work for once in a while, but didn't have much in terms of skills. But you talk about September 2nd, 1987, which was a Wednesday. And Stephen Small was asleep with his wife, Nancy, when the phone rang at 12:30 a.m. Their 15-year-old son, Ramsey, answered the phone. Tell us about this phone call.
Yeah, this was just after midnight. The son answered the phone. A man on the phone said, this is Officer So-and-so of the Kankakee Police Department. There's been a burglary at your father's place of business. He needs to come down. The son said, is this important? They've gone to bed. He said, yes, this is important. I need to talk. The son put Stephen on the line, and the man on the phone said, this is the police department. You need to come down here and secure the building and identify the items stolen. So Mr. Small got dressed and he went outside. He opened the garage, got in his Mercedes. The man on the phone was not a policeman. It was Danny Edwards. He was posing as a policeman to get Mr. Small to come out of the house. When Mr. Small got in his car, Danny got on the other side, pointed a gun at him, and said, let's go. So he had Mr. Small drive out of town to this wooded area in the sandhill. He forced Mr. Small to make a tape recording telling his wife that he'd been kidnapped and they wanted money. These are the instructions and so on and so forth. And then after he made the tape, Danny Edwards forced Mr. Small into the wooden box, which was in the ground. He then put the lid on the box and covered it with sand. Then Danny went, he ran maybe a half mile or so to a point where he had told Nancy to pick him up at a certain time. And then he went home.
Now, tell us about what happens at the Small residence and the phone call they receive and its contents.
Well, he had gotten Mr. Small out of the house after midnight. About 3:30 a.m., Danny called the Small house and talked to Mrs. Small and said, "We have your husband. We've kidnapped him. We want $1 million, and I will call you and let you know about the detail." Well, she called family members, and they called their lawyer, and they called the police. And since it was a kidnapping, the FBI was called, and the FBI came to the house, and they set up surveillance, and they set up a wiretap in case Edwards would call back again.
Now, what were the, we just didn't mention this, but this box that he was placed in and in sand, give us more about the accommodations that were made by Danny Edwards when he put Stephen Small in this box and what he told him in terms of when he likely would be out of this box and what did he provide?
It was quite a large box. It was not well made because he didn't have any kind of a skill, and it took him weeks to do it. Anybody else could have made this box, could have nailed this box up in 2 days less. It took Danny weeks, and it wasn't well made. He had a light in the box hooked up to a car battery. He had some candy bars. He filled an old milk jug with tap water, and he told Mr. Small that pipe coming out of the side of the box would provide enough air for 2 days. I guess Mr. Small believed him because he got in the box. He didn't put up a fight. And then Danny covered up the box, and he left. When he called at 3:30, all this was set in motion, and he said he would call back that afternoon. He did call back about 5 p.m., and he went to a nearby town and used the payphone. Well, the FBI had a tap on the phone, so they were able to tell where the phone call was coming from. And Danny said he would call back again that evening, and he did. Well, the FBI staked out that phone call. You know, this town is so small, it only had 3 payphones in the whole town. And this was a time when payphones were all over the place. The FBI staked out the payphone, hoping that he was dumb enough to come back and use the same phone. Well, he was dumb enough to come back, and he used one of the other payphones now. So they, for some reason, he had Nancy drive him to all of these calls that he made. I asked him why, and he said, "Well, you know, I don't know. I just wasn't thinking."
What were the directions that he gave to a horrified and confused Nancy Malls in terms of for the ransom and regarding the police and denominations of money? Give us all the details that she could hear. And was there some issue with the quality of the tape recording?
Yeah, he told her small denominations, non-consecutive, started giving directions of where to take the money. But it was so confused and so garbled that she couldn't quite understand. But it didn't matter because it just didn't happen. This was the 5 p.m. phone call, and the FBI got the license plate off the car. And by the time Danny got back to his house, the police were already staking out his townhouse because they knew the name and the address from getting the license plate. Well, later that evening, it's about 11:30, he called back. And again, he went to the same payphone. And he made some more demand. Now, one thing about payphones in those days, some payphones were not phone booths. They were standalone phones on a pole, and you could drive up to the phone and reach out the car window and make a phone call while sitting in the car. Nancy drove him to these things, but he didn't pull a payphone into the car. He had Nancy park 10 feet away each time, and then he got out to use the payphone because she didn't know what was going on. He didn't want her to know what was going on. And this is substantiated by the FBI surveillance on the later ransom calls he made on payphone. You know, they saw her parked 10 feet away, and they saw Danny get out. Kind of confusing. Why are you getting out and use the phone from the car? Well, he didn't use the phone from the car because he didn't want Nancy to know what was happening.
What did Nancy assume was happening given the reputation and character of her boyfriend?
She might have assumed that maybe he was back into drug dealing, but she didn't ask too many questions because he was physically abusive to her many times. And in fact, that week of the kidnapping, he was so jumpy and uptight, she asked him, what's going on with you? More odd than usual. He pulled out a gun and put it to her head and said, "If you don't stop asking questions, I'm going to blow your head off. Then I'm going to go upstairs and blow your son's head off." She didn't ask any more questions after that.
Tell us about the arrest, the circumstances, and then before we talk about them both being arrested and then brought in for questioning.
Well, the police knew who they were and where they lived the day of the kidnapping because they had tapped the phone, but they didn't want to move in on them because they thought it might endanger Mr. Small's life. So they let it go for about 2 days, and they finally decided, you know, enough time's gone by, we're moving in. So they raided the apartment with guns drawn and took Danny and Nancy in to the police station for questioning. Danny wasn't saying anything. He wasn't going to talk to them. Nancy cooperated because she didn't know what the heck was going on. She was questioned for 4 days, 13 hours over four okay. days, and there's not much she could have told them because she didn't know anything. You know, kidnapping? What are you talking about? They asked her a few questions about the whereabouts and the day of kidnapping and, you know, the tape recorder that Danny had Mr. Small used. Have you ever seen that? And she said, no, no, even though she had, because she was scared, she was confused. And at that time, she was still covering up for Danny that she didn't know what the situation was.
She was trying to cooperate. What did she establish for the police, according to her?
Well, she finally told exactly what happened as far as Danny had making her drive to these payphones. And the whole week of the kidnapping, Danny was all uptight about this and that. And she acted normal. You know, she took the dog to the vet. She went to her son's peewee football game. She helped the friends do this and that. And they all said she acted normal. You know, she wouldn't be acting normal if she knew what was going on.
So what happens in terms of Danny Edwards doesn't want to talk. They have a bunch of really damning evidence against him, including witnesses. What do they have in terms of real hard evidence against Danny Edwards? And what is the prosecution's plan? Before we talk about Nancy Risch and the prosecution's plan for her.
Well, when Danny had been arrested, you know, they were searching all over the place to find where Mr. Small might be held, especially his Mercedes would be someplace. Well, they found the Mercedes, and Danny heard them talking. I think they were talking on purpose. He would hear them. Once he knew they found the car, he knew they would find the burial site. So that's when he started cooperating. He said, okay, I'll take you to where he is. I'll know. And, you know, we'll dig him up. He should be okay. So he took the police out to the burial site. Now, by this time, Danny knew Mr. Small was dead because he had invaded the cops and the FBI tail who got in the motorcycle. And he invaded their tail and went out to the burial site, and he yelled into the pipe, Mr. Small. He said, there's no answer, so I knew he was dead. So anyway, he took the cops out to the burial site, thinking that he can save Mr. Small's life. And, you know, they dug it up, and Mr. Small was dead. And he acted like, oh, no, I can't believe it. But he already knew he was dead. So that was the end of any cooperation that Danny.
What does prosecution summarize in terms of, initially, the way they're going to prosecute him?
Well, they had all the evidence they needed. They had his shoes, which had sand on them. They had the fingerprints on the box. He was the one who took them to the box. They had an airtight case against him, so convicting him was easy.
Nancy Risch is charged with similar charges. What's the idea for prosecution? What do they believe she's actually guilty of? And tell us about how her lawyer severs the case for her benefit between her and her boyfriend.
She had a separate trial, which should have been a good thing. In her trial, which came after Danny, they used every bit of evidence they had against Danny, against Nancy, which was false, because all of this pointed to what Danny did. It didn't point to anything that Nancy did. The whole case was based on lies and conjecture and dramatic. Ficarro, the prosecutor, went to college theatrics before he went to law school because he said in an interview in a magazine, he said he wanted to be able to put on a dramatic show in the courtroom. And he did. He told so many lies. He said that witnesses in the store said that Danny and Nancy both bought a gallon of distilled water to use in the box. Well, the water in the box was tap water in an old milk jug. And it was not even introduced as evidence. He just said it. And so many other things. These plastic ties that Danny bought. He bought it for something he was doing at home. It had nothing to do with the kidnapping. He didn't use the plastic ties in Mr. Small. He had used handcuffs. Ficarro said these were used in the kidnapping. The judge said, no, you can't say that. You can't introduce it. He said it anyway. And then he got a receipt from the store for the Twist guys that had Danny and Nancy's name on it. Well, much later in the appeal, Nancy's lawyer went to the store and got the receipt, and there was no names on it. So it was just one lie after another. He would say, in a summary to the jury, he would say, such and such witness testified that they saw Danny and Nancy buy candy bars for the box. You look at transcripts, they never said that. But he said, he told the jury that they said. It was just one lie after another. And he was experienced and he was dramatic. And Nancy had just about the worst lawyer in town, which is what the Smalls wanted. You know, every single public defender and every single attorney in Kankakee County would not take the case because they were afraid of the Smalls. So a judge assigned the worst lawyer in Kankakee County. He'd never tried him. So he got this experienced, dramatic guy against this weak attorney. And one of the jurors later said, you know, if Nancy had had Picaro instead of the man she had, he might have gotten off.
At Danny Edwards' trial, we didn't talk about this, but his trial is different than hers in that he's eligible for the death penalty. Now, what does he say in all his statements and also what was said at his own trial in terms of Nancy's, Rish's guilt, aiding and abetting, is what the prosecution claimed, helping him in his crimes?
Well, he didn't testify at his own trial. So he didn't say anything.
Yes.
But to the police, he's trying to make all these excuses. He was saying Mitch, he owed money to Mitch Levitt, so that's why he had to do this. He said big drug kingpins in Chicago were putting him up to it. He got some help from the black cowboys out in that part of the county. All this stuff to take some of the guilt off of himself. The police didn't believe any of what he said. But the one thing he said from the beginning, from the time they got arrested, was Nancy had nothing to do with this. He kept saying that.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. Ladies, here's some information. Did you know that women were excluded from clinical research policy by federal law until 1993? Women belong in scientific research. Ritual knows. They conducted a university-led clinical trial for their Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin to assess its efficacy. The results were, it increased vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks. My wife Lisa and I both decided to try Ritual just based on the research they'd done to develop their multivitamin in the first place. It's been a few years now, and we both continue to rely on Ritual multivitamin, and we really like the convenient monthly delivery. This multivitamin is made with high quality and traceable key nutrients in clean, bioavailable forms. With 9 key nutrients in 2 capsules per day, their unique bed-let-in oil capsule technology is even patented. Their capsule has a delayed release design to help make it gentle on an empty stomach. Ritual is all about hot data and stone cold facts. Get to know your nutrients on a deeper level with 20% off during your first month. Visit ritual.com/murder to start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. Now, talk about the vigorous prosecution going for a death penalty, and one of the prosecutors, the guy leading the charge, is a guy named Ficarro. And so his depiction of Danny Edwards is that this was no accident, that he would have intended to murder Stephen Smalls. But he also includes in that instructions to the jury or statements to the jury that Nancy Rish is aiding and abetting and an accomplice to all of these kidnapping and murder.
I don't know that he mentioned Nancy much at Danny's trial. It was all Danny did it. He planned it. He did this. The whole thing was him. It was a different story at Nancy's trial. All of a sudden, Nancy did it. Nancy planned it. Nancy made the phone call. Contrary to the evidence, you know, Mr. Small's son told the police it was a man's voice in the phone. He told the FBI it was a man's voice. He testified at both trials. It was a man's voice on the phone. And now Ficarro was saying Nancy made the call. And he said that in a summary to the jury. And Nancy's lawyer was so inept, he didn't object, which he should have. And because he didn't object, she could not use this as the point on appeal.
She testifies on her own behalf at her trial. Why does this not have some credibility?
Well, guilty people usually don't testify in their own behalf. Nancy was not guilty, and she testified because she wanted to tell what she knew and what happened. However, she was a naive 25-year-old young woman, and Picaro was a much older, experienced bulldog. And he bullied her on the stand for hours and beat her down and tried to get her to say things that didn't happen.
We mentioned earlier that the Small family was involved in radio broadcast and newspapers and were in controlling situations with a paper called the Daily Journal, I believe. Jean Alice Small, what was the media coverage like from the Smalls who controlled all the media?
Well, the media attention was intense. And it was almost close to being objective, but not quite. I mean, they couldn't say Nancy's guilty until the jury said it.
It's a death penalty case. He was eligible. What was the verdict from the jury? Did it take long to get that verdict?
The jury came back in, I think it was like 11 minutes on Danny and said guilty, death penalty. With Nancy, it took a lot longer, but it came back guilty. She was not eligible for the death penalty because she didn't actually participate in it. You know, if she didn't participate in it, why would she be in charge at all? But she was given life without parole.
Now, what about the appeals process and what's life like behind bars for Nancy Risch?
Well, you know, it's not pleasant, of course, but she endured. She had an appellate defender who took her case, filed motions over the year. In prison, Nancy got her education, got her college education, got some degrees in food service. She helped there's a program called Helping Paws, which trains service dogs. She became an expert dog groomer. She's a model prisoner. Some of the women who I talked to in prison said that she was a role model and an inspiration. So, and you know, she was ideal.
You talk about one of the appeals in 2004 in December. Tell us about a couple of the events there, and especially about the electric chair allegation.
Well, when she was being questioned initially, one of the detectives was threatening her, saying that she was going to get the electric chair, even though she wasn't eligible for it, and even though we no longer had one. It was all intimidation, trying to beat her down, but they couldn't do it because she couldn't tell them anything because she didn't know anything, because she wasn't involved.
How did she explain her lies? Because the prosecution used the instances where she initially lied and another story came out to make it so that she had no credibility with her story whatsoever.
Well, when she was arrested, like I said, she didn't know what was going on. They asked her for whereabouts that evening, if she had seen a certain tape recorder that Danny had used to force Mr. Small to make a statement. And she said no, she hadn't seen it, and lied about her whereabouts. But she was scared and she was confused. And at that point, she was still covering up for Danny because she didn't know what was going on. These are minor lies, if you will, that had nothing to do with the kidnapping and murder, had nothing to do with anything. But they use this as a point that, well, she can't be believed because she lied about them.
You talk about her parole hearing in 2014 being marred by the same type of wrongful evidence that was allowed. Tell us about that.
Well, this is the only parole hearing she had up to that 2014. Now, you remember when Danny called the house posing as a policeman, a Small son answered the phone, and he talked to Danny for a few minutes. The son told the police, it was a man's voice on the phone, told the FBI, it was a man's voice on the phone, testified at Danny and Nancy's trial, it was a man's voice on the phone. It was a man's voice on the phone. That's what he testified to. In 2014, he sent a victim impact statement to the parole board, and it began, quote, "The first time I heard Nancy Risch's voice was on September 2nd, 1987, when she called our house. It was totally a lie. It was contrary to what he had testified to. His younger brother also sent a victim impact statement saying it was Nancy who called the house, even though he didn't hear the phone call, and he never heard Nancy's voice." This is the kind of control, and this is the kind of people the Small family is.
You were the only person to be able to get an interview with Danny Edwards, and you also spoke to Nancy Risch behind bars as well. Tell us about the interaction with Danny Edwards first.
Well, he didn't want to talk to me. I had contacted him numerous times and he wouldn't even get back to me. Well, finally I got through to him and we talked. He invited me to the prison and I spent, you know, many days in prison talking to him. A lot of what he wanted to talk about was the Bible, because for 20 some years, he'd been a born-again Christian, studies the Bible intensely. He writes essays and teaches Bible studies. That's the main focus of life now. So we talked a lot about that, but also I asked him about the kidnapping. He said, ask me anything you want. I asked him all the questions that I could. He answered without hesitation. He said he was good to get it off his chest. He said he would never lie because he would never swear to God's name and then tell a lie, because that's the worst thing possible.
And Nancy's involvement. You now had this person that you believed that was being honest, and you asked him about her involvement. What did he say?
He said Nancy had nothing to do with it. He didn't know anything about it. I couldn't tell her about it because she would not go along with it. As far as her helping or in any way, he said, no, she didn't help in any way. He said, if she had helped me, it would have gone a lot easier. So the only reason I put Mr. Small in a box is because I was acting alone, and it was the only way I could hold him. If Nancy was helping me or anybody was helping me, we could have put him in a hotel or put him back of the apartment or something.
Right.
And, you know, we got on him. But I had things to do. I had to, you know, arrange for these ransom calls, and I had to do this and that. I was acting alone. If anybody was helping me, I wouldn't have had to put him in a box.
But Jesus has an opportunity to stop for these messages.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Now, you talked about the impedance, the who might be the person, who likely was the person that interfered with these appeals. Tell us about this judge and his actions.
Well, Judge Gordon Lustfeld heard appeals, or let's just say motions for this and that, and he denied everything. He wouldn't allow anything. He said that anything would have to be based on new evidence that would be compelling enough to change the verdict, or any reasonable juror would not vote to convict. Nancy's lawyer said, we have new evidence, but we want an evidentiary hearing to present the evidence. Lustfeld wouldn't allow it. Well, how can you introduce new evidence if you won't allow an evidentiary hearing? This judge was, you know, people in the courtroom were shaking their heads every time they had a hearing because he was so biased. Nancy's lawyers, Margaret Byrne and Stephen Becker, Chicago, thought this judge was so biased that they filed a petition asking for a new judge based on bias. Well, the petition went to the head judge, and the head judge had to assign it to another judge to be heard. Well, guess what judge he picked? He picked Judge Lustfeld. And Judge Lustfeld decided that Judge Lustfeld was not biased.
Now, you talk about Nancy's attorneys filing for a resentence hearing in 2021. Based on what law? Can you explain?
Well, a law was passed in 2016 that said domestic abuse must be taken into account at sentencing. Well, Nancy was sentenced in 1988. Was not taken into account, wasn't even thought of. But Nancy's lawyer said, okay, since it wasn't taken into account, we want a resentencing based on domestic abuse. Danny abused her a lot, very many times. Like I said, he even put a gun to her head once. They had a number of witnesses, women who knew Nancy back in the day, who were all set to testify about all the abuse they saw. They also had expert witnesses on domestic abuse. They had a good case. Well, by that time, the state said, you know what, we can't win this. They've got too much. So they cut a deal saying, we'll give you a new sentence, which will amount to time served, which was 34 years in prison.
Wow.
For crimes she did not commit. They made that deal. A new judge approved it. And in the beginning of 2022, Nancy finally walked out of prison.
Yeah, incredible. You talk about near the end of the book, and it's interesting, where Danny Edwards might have gotten this harebrained idea from in the first place. And you talk about the Barbara Jane Mackey story, which made national headlines, was made into a couple made-for-television movies. It was a big thing, and it was a person involved named Stephen Crist. And some of the particulars in this echo and mirror what happened in this particular case, in this particular case involving Stephen Small.
Yes. He was kidnapped and buried alive and held for ransom in 1968. They made a TV movie out of this that she survived because the kidnapper built the box the way it should have been, with air coming in and exhaust going out, which Stephen Small's box did not have. They made this into a TV movie in 1972. And one of Danny's friends told me that in 1972, he and Danny were in the basement watching this TV movie, and very similar circumstances. And Danny said, you know what? I think somebody could get away with that.
Yes, some of the particulars in this fictional story really were very, very similar and seemed to be much beyond a coincidence that he did not see this television movie.
Yeah, but it wasn't fictional. It actually happened. Barbara Jean Mack. But they were both watching this movie, and Danny was just sort of transfixed by it. He said, somebody could get away with doing that.
You've called this book Small Justice, and I know it's a play on words, but tell us why you chose that title.
Small Justice is, of course, named because of the Small family. But in Kankakee, if you are wealthy and connected in the big shot, you can get away with stuff. If you're just an ordinary citizen with no connections, no money, no influence, like Nancy was, they will nail you. It's Small Justice with a small S and Small Justice with a capital S. That's kind of justice to give them food.
Right. Tell us about your book about Governor Small, Len Small, Governors and Gangsters. Tell us about this book.
Len Small was elected governor in 1920. Before he was governor of Illinois, he was the state treasurer of Illinois. He embezzled about $2 million, 1916, 1917, which is, I can't even tell you how much money that is today. He did it by, treasurer is supposed to invest the state fund over about 300 or 400 banks, because back then they didn't have FDI insurance. So you had to spread the money out and keep the bank failed. He invested half of the state's money in one bank, and it was a bank that did not exist. He loaned that money out to the Chicago meat packers at 6 to 8% interest, and he paid state 2 to 3%. So he got away with about $2 million in a couple of years. Well, as soon as he became governor, a new state treasurer took over and saw this on the books. So Small was indicted, and just a few months after being sworn in as governor, he went on trial. His lawyers had a defense saying the divine right of kings, the king can do no wrong. That's why Governor Small broke the law. Well, the judge didn't buy that. So he went on trial. The state put on a prosecution that lasted 9 weeks. They had every scrap of paper they had him nailed. When it came time for the defense, Small's lawyer said, we're not going to put on it. The judge was shocked. Well, the jury came back not guilty. Well, it turns out the jury was bribed by men sent by Al Capone, who was a good friend of Governor Small. Governor Small sold all kinds of pardons and paroles to Small, to Capone's men, and anybody else who could pay the price. I'll give you one example. Harry Guzik ran houses of prostitution, forcing young, innocent women into prostitution. One woman escaped, and Guzik was arrested and went on trial. He was convicted and sentenced to the penitentiary. He didn't spend one day in jail. Governor Small pardoned him immediately. The next day, he was back in the prosecution business.
And you talk about how Small family was sacrificed in some way by the political aspirations of Governor George Ryan.
He commuted all 167 death sentences in Illinois to life in prison. And one of those lives he saved was Danny Edwards. The Small family never forgave him.
And what of Nancy Risch after 34 years? Update.
He is now living on her own. She's working a job. She's trying to get adjusted. And I'd asked her about being on a podcast. She doesn't want anything to do with it. She wants to forget the whole thing ever happened. And she's adjusted quite well. She's always been a religious person and a positive person.
Yeah, fascinating. I want to thank you very much, Jim Ridings, for coming on and talking about your extraordinary book, Small Justice. For those that might want to take further look, do you have a website or do you do any social media?
I do. JimRidings.com. JimRidings.com.
Thank you so much, Jim Ridings, for coming on and talking about Small Justice. You have a great evening, and thank you, and good night.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you.